There was no hope of reaching a verdict. That's what the jury foreman said. It was day 6 of deliberations in Christopher Deedy's first trial for the death of Colin Eldertz. There would have to be a second trial. Colin Eldertz's family began to cry. Deedy hugged his lawyer. "I love you," Deedy told him. "You did a good job." The Eldertz family left the courthouse in silence, walked quickly past reporters and photographers. No comment, not for a month. Then his parents called a press conference. His stepmother said,
"We have decided to no longer suffer in silence."
They were angry at prosecutors for not introducing a lesser charge, like manslaughter. They felt betrayed, let down. They wanted a new attorney put on the case.
"Our entire family felt abandoned by the prosecutor's office. We just want this guy in jail, in prison."
Maybe their disappointment in the prosecutor's office would have been tempered a little if they had known this. Between the start of Christopher Deedy's first trial on July 8th and the announcement of a hung jury on August 26th, at least 165 people were killed by law enforcement officers in the United States. Most of those people were armed, but at least a quarter of them were not. The only police officer convicted of wrongdoing in one of those deaths? An off-duty cop who kidnapped and then bludgeoned a man to death. This is Offshore, Stories from Hawaii. I'm Jessica Terrell. This is episode 7 of our first season, A Killing in Waikiki. In this season, we're looking at what happened the night an off-duty federal officer killed a Native Hawaiian man in 2011. The episodes are chronological, so if you're just starting to listen, go back and find episode 1 and be sure to listen to all the others first. It's a case that's inextricably entangled with Hawaii's long history of race relations and federal intervention. The special agent and the Eldertz family, they also got caught up in a conflict that extends well beyond the borders of Hawaii.
Protests built in response to the officer-involved shootings.
Anger and frustration still on the streets of El Cajon today.
Protesting in both Chicago and Cleveland overnight.
Many people in the crowd called for more police accountability.
Deedy's trials, they're taking place in the midst of a major transformation in America.
A lot of people who maybe wouldn't have doubted police in the past, they're taking a second look at all these issues.
That's a guy named David Harris. He's a professor at the University of Pittsburgh Law School and the host of a podcast called Criminal Injustice.
People today seem to want to see criminal prosecutions of police officers when a civilian dies in an encounter with a police officer, but it remains relatively rare to have a criminal prosecution go forward.
There's several reasons for that, Harris says. The first is that usually prosecutors and cops are on the same team, allies. So there's a natural reluctance for a local prosecutor to take on a criminal case against the local police department. But Harris says even if a case does go to court, prosecutors often have a really hard time persuading jurors to convict a cop.
When you put a police officer on trial, you are essentially saying to most civilians that the usual good guy, the person that you're supposed to rely on for protection or help in an emergency, that's the bad guy. You are asking most members of most juries to kind of turn the world upside down. And that's not an easy thing to do.
And it's often a defense tactic to vilify the victim in these shootings. The contrasting images of Deedy and Eldertz. Honolulu County Prosecutor Keith Kaneshiro says that was a challenge in the Deedy case.
You have a law enforcement officer who's very clean-cut, good-looking, intelligent, and the jurors look at that. And then they will look at the victim and they'll judge the victim and compare the victim with the law enforcement officer, which they shouldn't do. They should just look at the conduct.
Here's the attorney representing the Eldertz family in a civil suit against Deedy, a guy named Michael Green.
They made the victim the defendant. That's what they did. They made him the aggressor, and they turned this upside down so Deedy became the potential victim of this case. How anybody could be justified, any officer trained to disarm people who have weapons without having to kill them. For him to do this and take out his weapon and start shooting under these circumstances is beyond belief.
There's one more issue Harris points to. Maybe the biggest reason that few police officers face prosecution for killing a civilian.
Police officers have the legal right to use force, and the only question is whether that force was excessive. And that's a different, harder to prove question than just regular use of force by a civilian.
It was a huge issue in Dee Dee's first trial. Something that the jury foreman said they simply couldn't resolve.
What is deadly force? When is it okay to use? You know, he did shoot him. Could he have done something else?
Dee Dee's second trial started on July 10th, 2014, almost exactly a year after opening statements were heard in his first trial. The prosecutor's office did not assign a new lawyer to the case, despite complaints from Eldert's family. Here's Honolulu County Prosecutor Keith Kaneshiro.
I don't think any family will be totally happy if you have a mistrial. And that's reflected upon the reaction to the verdict. We expect that to happen. But we don't try case based on what they want because they're not the legal experts. And the victim is important. But we represent the state of Hawaii. We don't represent the victim.
Prosecutors also didn't change their legal strategy or what charges they pursued. In the first trial, and again in the second trial, prosecutors insisted on trying Dee Dee for murder. Colin Eldert's family, they wanted manslaughter to be an option, but prosecutors weren't budging. They said there was no evidence of manslaughter. The defense and the judge agreed with them.
Manslaughter, you have to determine whether there was reckless conduct for manslaughter. That's one of the elements. The conduct has to be reckless. In the particular case, when a person intentionally aims a gun at someone and fires a gun, that is not reckless. That's intentional.
In the second trial, the judge dropped something of a bombshell. This time, she would let the jurors consider manslaughter and assault charges. Why did the judge change her mind? In between the end of Dee Dee's first case and the start of his second case, the Hawaii Supreme Court issued two opinions, basically clarifying when jurors should be allowed to consider those lesser charges. And the Supreme Court did that because of two other trials where they said the judge was wrong not to include lesser charges. The judge in both cases? The same judge on the Dee Dee case. But when she changed her mind in Dee Dee's case, it was at the very end of the second trial, after both sides had built their case around murder, not manslaughter. Most of the witnesses and the arguments were the same in the second trial. There were a few witnesses who weren't called back, including one of the Marines who'd perjured himself on the stand. But the biggest changes, aside from the lesser charges being added at the end of the trial, Dee Dee had a new legal team, two local attorneys, two non-Hawley attorneys. Here's defense attorney Miles Briner. We talked to him last week about how hard it can be to get an impartial jury in Hawaii when you have a client who's from out of state.
I remember in the first trial, it was Mr. Dee Dee, and on either side of him, he had two Caucasian attorneys. There was a different team on the second trial. We had two local attorneys, male, female, and I think they presented a different image to the jury and a different approach to the evidence.
And while the Eldert's family was mostly silent during the first trial, this time they were marching in the streets.
Justice for Colin now! Remember Colin Eldert!
They were connecting their son's death to the history of Hawaii, to the Hawaiian sovereignty movement, and to the growing pushback against police shootings across America. Colin always told me he was going to be famous, his stepmom posted on Facebook 3 weeks into the second trial. Please, please, let him be famous for saving another family from the suffering we are going through.
Justice for Colin now! Remember Colin Eldert! Justice for Colin now!
In Christopher Dee Dee's first trial, and again in his second, a lot of time was given to this one question. When exactly are police officers allowed to fire their weapons?
There's often some ambiguity there.
That's a guy named David Klinger. He's a professor of criminal justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. He's also a former cop who does a lot of consulting and training on deadly force.
Part of trying to understand the puzzle of the use of deadly force is understanding that situations are not always clear-cut and not always black and white.
And Klinger says that there are basically two situations where an officer is allowed to fire their weapon. One of those has to do with fleeing felons and really doesn't apply in the Dee Dee case. The other circumstance where cops can shoot is known as the defensive life doctrine. And it basically says,
you're only allowed to use deadly force to defend yourself or another innocent third party from an imminent threat of death or serious bodily injury. So a situation where someone is pointing a gun, someone is actually shooting at the police, someone is charging at police officers with a hatchet, whatever the case might be, that notion of you need to shoot to defend life.
It sounds pretty straightforward, right? Well, it gets a little complicated.
The sorts of circumstances that might lead a given police officer to reasonably fear that his or her life is in jeopardy or another third party is in jeopardy has to be viewed through what the Supreme Court says the totality of the circumstances that the officer is involved in.
In other words, use of force can't be judged by what we know in hindsight. It has to be based on the information available to an officer in that moment. A lot of information. Can an officer disengage? Is there a subject resisting commands? What's the size and strength of the subject? Where is all this happening? Is it at night? Are there other dangerous factors at play? How quickly is the situation escalating? But what that means is the need for deadly force can be really subjective.
And so we could have a situation where two police officers see the exact same thing, but they make different decisions about using deadly force. One fires, the other one withholds fire, because they are defining the situation somewhat differently.
Like this one time, Klinger and his partner were driving down a street in Los Angeles. He was a young beat cop then.
I'm the passenger officer, and I spot a guy who I had arrested before, and I knew that he was mentally defective. And he's got a gun in his hand, standing in the middle of the street.
The other cop slams on the brakes, of course. And when he does, the man in the street points the gun directly at Klinger's partner. It's totally a deadly force situation. Except for this. Klinger was pretty sure it was a toy gun. He'd arrested the guy before. And he knew the guy had mental problems, but wasn't dangerous.
He knew nothing about this guy. So my definition of the situation is I've got a crazy guy who might have a toy gun. My partner doesn't have that same definition.
Klinger's partner didn't shoot. But if he had, he would have been justified in doing so, because he had a reasonable belief that his life and that of his partner's was at risk. In Didi's case, the defense argued that Didi had the right, nay, the responsibility, to protect himself and his friend from what was a real threat of death or serious injury. At that point, it wasn't just Eldertz and Didi fighting. They had friends in the fray. And the defense argued Didi's friend was in real danger. Prosecutors, meanwhile, argue that Didi and his friend were just losing a fist fight. They weren't in danger of death or great bodily harm. The challenge for jurors is it's not just a question of figuring out in retrospect if Didi's life was in danger. They have to figure out if Didi believed his life was in danger when he drew his weapon, which is a different standard entirely. Again, the law says we can't judge an officer's actions based on hindsight, but on whether their reactions were reasonable based on all the factors they were assessing in that moment. And there's one more point about this idea of what constitutes imminent danger. If it really is so subjective, if it depends on how an officer views the situation in that moment, how does the race or ethnicity of a suspect impact that? Is it possible that if Eldertz had been a white guy, Didi would have assessed the threat differently? The answer to that really depends on who you're talking to. Harris, the criminology professor from Pittsburgh, says implicit bias can have an enormous impact on how officers judge situations.
When I started in my career many years ago, we all thought of racial bias in terms of that old TV show with the character Archie Bunker. Explicit use of the N-word and stereotypes and proudly bigoted and biased. We know a lot more now than we used to about how racial biases impact what we do. And we know that most of what we should be thinking about is unconscious bias. These biases exist in the minds of almost everyone, and they can operate in ways that change our actions without us realizing it and without us having a bad character. It can cause police officers to believe that black people that they encounter are larger, more dangerous, more prone to violence, and more likely to be armed than white people.
But Klinger, the former cop who teaches at the University of Missouri-St. Louis, is much more skeptical.
Race is probably the touchiest issue that we're dealing with presently in the United States regarding the use of deadly force. But interestingly enough, in my interviews, the only time officers have talked about race is that they want to avoid shooting minority people because they know that there will be hell to pay in terms of community sentiment and negative press.
Klinger argues that research on implicit bias in policing, it's not as clear-cut as some people make it out to be.
Without getting into too heavy a critique of the literature, it's not compelling to me because there's such a huge jump between the laboratory and what officers deal with. And further, the more realistic the scenario in the laboratory, the less the impact of race as a factor that affects the decisions.
Being aware of the possibility of implicit bias isn't a bad thing, Klinger says. In fact, all federal law enforcement agencies, including DDs, are in the process of implementing implicit bias training. But Klinger sees other ways to address deadly force.
I think we could probably get a better bang for our buck if we spent more time making sure that officers had really sound tactical training, knew how to structure situations in ways that reduce the likelihood of having to use deadly force, and then making sure that they follow those instructions out in the field.
This national debate about whether and when lethal force is appropriate and how it impacts communities of color, it's not something the Eldert's family ever expected to get involved in. They just weren't really political people before their son died. Here's Kalama Naheyo.
They weren't the type of people to make a lot of noise about things. This was not something that the family ever wanted to do.
But situations change, and so do people. The day after Didi's second trial started, protesters held a Justice for Colin Eldert's rally outside Iolani Palace. It was an event that Eldert's father said he would never forget. He wrote in a Facebook post, "For the first time in nearly 3 years, I felt hopeful and encouraged that there are good and kind people still out there in this world." And he said his family supported the following goals: the demilitarization of Hawaii, the respect of our people and land by the visitors vacationing in Hawaii, quote, the ability to use any word in our native tongue, including the word haole, without repercussion, and a ban on government officials carrying guns while drinking. Didi's supporters, they're also rallying behind him, trying to use his case to make legislative changes. Didi's friends and coworkers start a website to raise awareness about his case. They start online fundraising campaigns to help offset the enormous cost of traveling back and forth to Hawaii. Law enforcement organizations host fundraisers for Didi, happy hours and mixers. And they use his case as a warning, as a way to bolster support for a new federal law that would offer protection for officers like Didi, would allow their cases to be tried in federal and not local court. As a federal law enforcement officer, you are a target, they warn members. This should not be the case. You can imagine that if there's one place that's going to be upset about federal intervention in local cases, about federal agencies protecting their own people, it's going to be Hawaii. And Honolulu County Prosecutor Keith Kaneshiro, he's pretty pissed at how the feds handled Didi's case.
It's an issue that is now cropping up as to what is the federal government's role in local law enforcement? Why do they sometimes interfere? Do they sometimes not do what they're supposed to be doing? Because they're the federal government and they're better than us. They're better than state government and then local government.
Remember how Didi's sobriety is pretty much irresolvable because there was no test performed? Didi testified in court that he would have taken a breathalyzer if he'd been provided access to a State Department representative. But Kaneshiro said,
the police did a very extensive investigation. But the one thing that was not done was to give the alcohol tests for Didi. And that was because the federal government stepped in and they stopped it.
Really? Is that normal?
It shouldn't be. They stepped in and said that their personnel should not be tested. Because they were there at the scene, and my understanding is when they went to the hospital, that's where it was stopped. That's why there was no alcohol test given. It should have been done, but.
Was this the State Department, or do you know when you say federal officials?
I don't recall offhand, but I know it's the federal officials, so the police officers.
How badly do you think that damaged your ability to make a case, or do you see that as like really over the line interfering?
I say this should not be interfering with investigation, because this is an investigation of violation of state law. Federal government should not be involved.
The State Department declined to speak with us about anything related to Didi's case. Didi's lawyers, they wouldn't comment on whether Kaneshiro's statement about federal intervention was accurate.
That's a concern that I have. And it's a concern I have is the federal government looking down upon the state of Hawaii and saying that, you know, we don't care what you do. We're going to do whatever we want to do. And that should not be the case. All federal law enforcement and all law enforcement should respect other law enforcement agencies and what we're doing and what we're trying to do.
Didi's second trial goes faster than the first. There are fewer witnesses, a lot less media attention. Jury deliberations begin on August 5th, 2014. The jury takes a several-day recess to wait out a tropical storm. Then, on August 14th, a decision.
The elder Tohono leaves the courtroom visibly upset after a jury finds Christopher Didi not guilty of second-degree murder. The jury was hung on other sentencing options. And
Didi grins. He hugs his wife. The elder's family leaves the courthouse once again in tears. The judge rules that Didi can be tried again on the lesser charges of manslaughter and assault. The court sets a date for the third trial. The case isn't over yet, and nobody's backing down. This is Offshore, Stories from Hawaii. I'm Jessica Terrell. What happens when high-profile trials like the Didi case and the Massey case are over? For families of the killers and the victims, is there really ever an end? That's next week on Offshore. Offshore is produced by Honolulu Civil Beat, a member-supported nonprofit news organization dedicated to covering the real Hawaii. Donate to support this podcast and our journalism at civilbeat.org. Offshore is distributed by PRX. Offshore's producer and executive producer is Ben Adair. Our editor is Patty Epler. April Estrelon is our assistant producer. I'll be back next week.